This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
UK is marking the death of its longest-reigning monarch amid calls in former colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British sovereign as their head of state. Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region is reportedly witnessing fierce battles, with President Volodymyr Zelensky saying forces have recaptured more than 30 settlements in the area. And the Iranian embassy in Brussels has denounced NATO for repeating what it calls Albania's baseless accusations about Tehran's role in a recent cyber attack on the country. Hello, everybody, a very warm welcome to World News. And now, our top story: global reverberations continue following the passing of Britain's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, at the age of 96 after 70 years on the throne. Britain's new monarch, King Charles, made his first public appearance to address the nation and thank well-wishers, with a state funeral plan followed by the coronation ceremony. Amina Taylor looked ahead to the challenges facing the new king.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well-wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolised the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the king instead of God save the queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a seven-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there are questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
Calls are growing on former colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Now this after the ascension of Charles to the British throne after the death of Mother Queen Elizabeth II. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed unease about the change of leadership from Elizabeth to Charles. There are doubts about a role of a distant monarch should play in the 21st century. In Jamaica and the Bahamas, people are calling for reparations and an apology for slavery. This while Barbados, one of a dozen Caribbean nations which are Commonwealth members, ditched the Queen as head of state last year. Jamaica has signaled it may follow suit. A survey showed over 56% of Jamaicans favor removing the British monarch as head of state. Activists in the region have also argued that Charles' accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery reparations. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to tell us more about the challenges that new British monarch will face after ascending the throne.
Charles is really getting on in age, and you don't know me, that this family has quite an age longevity, of course, as we know, but how long will his reign last? Will he be able to make that kind of impact? He's also, don't forget, now presiding over a very different kind of Britain that's emerging. What with all of the energy crisis and the world in flux as we see it around the globe today, Britain is also going to have to find its own way with the Brexit scenarios, with the relationships with China, America, etc., to balance the war in Ukraine. He's coming into a world which is probably equally fraught. I mean, the Queen herself came at the tail end of the Second World War, of course, and he's also going to have to deal with a complete change in the type of society that we're living in, the information age and the biotechnological age, the age of transhumanism, the age of, if you like, all sorts of modern technological advances will have its own challenges.
And now over to Ukraine, where President says the country's forces have retaken control of dozens of towns as they push a counteroffensive against Russian forces in the northeast.
Up to now, the armed forces of Ukraine have liberated and took control of about 30 settlements in the Kharkiv region. In a number of villages in the area, activities to check and secure the territory are ongoing. Gradually, we take over new settlements. Everywhere, we return the Ukrainian flag and safety to our people.
Volodymyr Zelensky comments, follow reports, fierce battles are underway in the region of Kharkiv. Moscow has not confirmed any advances by the Ukrainian forces, though, but says it is sending in more reinforcements. Intense fighting is also raging in the south, where a Ukrainian counteroffensive is making progress in the Russian-held region of Kherson. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say that 8 people were killed and over a dozen injured in attacks on a town in the eastern Donbas region. Russia has denied targeting civilians. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions war on Russia. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off than in decades, Rami Mazahiri reports.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know. And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed, because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's embassy in Brussels has slammed NATO for rehashing Albanian accusations that Tehran was behind a recent cyber attack on the country. The embassy rejected the accusations as baseless, denouncing NATO for aiding and abetting anti-Iran cyber attacks itself. It's also urged NATO members to refrain from harboring terrorists. Tehran has cut diplomatic ties with Tehran over the alleged attack. Tehran says it is itself a victim of cyber attacks and condemns the use of cyberspace as a tool to attack the critical infrastructure of other states. Relations between Tehran and Tehran have been tense since the Balkan nation started providing safe haven to the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO. The MKO has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians. The group was once blacklisted by the U.S. and the EU, but has been delisted since by both and enjoys their full support. Earlier, we spoke to historian and social activist Olsi Jaseshi about Albania's decision to sever diplomatic ties with Tehran. Here he is.
Albania has become a hostile country to Iran since 2016, when it was ordered by the Americans to host the terrorist organization of Mujahideen al-Halk. Since their relocation to Albania, the Mujahideens, they have carried numerous cyber attacks and propaganda attacks and maybe even terrorist attacks against the Islamic Republic. These attacks, which go contrary to the penal code of Albania, have gone unpunished. The Albanian government learns about this, but they are afraid from the Americans to act. The Mujahideens are used in Albania by Israel, and if you see the Israeli medias today and yesterday, they are very happy with what Prime Minister Edi Rama is doing. So the latest attack against Iran most probably was coordinated with Israel, but very surprisingly, we had even the American and the British government, which in a way they supported the extreme measure by Edi Rama.
Now, the U.S. continues to plunder Syria's national resources, smuggling a new batch of stolen oil into Iraq. Now, according to Syrian media, convoy contains 88 oil tankers. U.S. forces have now transferred the convoy to their bases in northern Iraq. Just last month, Syrian oil ministry said U.S. and militant groups that it supports pillaged over 80% of Syria's daily crude production in the first half of this year. U.S. maintains nearly 1,000 troops in Syria, with the alleged goal of fighting terrorist groups. Syria has time and again condemned what it calls U.S. occupation of the country and the looting of its oil. A terrorist attack targeted the Russian embassy in Afghanistan's capital Kabul earlier in the week. It claimed the lives of two Russian staffers and civilians. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility, but there's more to this attack than meets the eye.
Thank you. It could have been dismissed as just another blast, but this was anything but that. An explosion at the entrance of the Russian embassy in the Afghan capital, which killed two Russian embassy staff members along with many civilians. The IS Khorasan or Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility, and this is where this attack is different from the others that Daesh has executed. This is the first attack claimed by the Daesh on a diplomatic mission in Afghanistan after the Taliban took over the country in 2021. This is important in many respects. The terrorist group first emerged in Syria and Iraq. It was a well-known fact that the U.S. and its allies supported the group, especially in Syria.
And so it seems that Daesh, which was very likely actually created by the U.S. Military intelligence community, is once again serving as the sort of American Arab Legion. And they have, you know, they've never showed up anywhere outside of the sort of the Syria-Iraq region before. But just as the Taliban was making big progress in Afghanistan, suddenly Daesh came along and started attacking the Taliban and in chaos.
But then alarming news surfaced last year that they had moved to Afghanistan from the West Asia and posed a threat to regional security. The SCO last year raised the alarm when it announced that these terrorists were moved from Syrian and Iraqi conflict zones and posed a threat to the SCO member states. The Hezbollah Secretary General echoed the same sentiments. Said Hassan Nasrallah stated that according to reports he had received, the U.S.'s exit from Afghanistan pointed to Washington's role in transferring Daesh's terrorists from Iraq and the eastern bank of the Euphrates River to Afghanistan.
So this is a typical situation in which the U.S. government has done this all over the world in dozens of countries. They create terrorism to spread chaos in order to try to discredit the regime that they want to overthrow or hobble. And in this case, the reasons are obvious. The U.S. wants to win the great game. It wants to occupy the center of the grand chessboard in the struggle for Eurasia, as Brzezinski said. And it's losing, and it's trying to essentially win the war in Afghanistan by other means through supporting this obviously false flag terrorist group, so-called Daesh, which is purely and simply an American front.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It was quite clear from day one that the Zionist regime military would not practice justice for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghla on May 11th of this year. What comes to mind is that how many times the fabricated regime of Israel has ever practiced justice? And how can you expect from an apartheid regime who brazenly steals land and kills innocent people to practice justice? These are the questions that need to be answered by the Zionist regime's allies and aides, the US in particular. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. The website of Palestine Chronicle wrote, Abu Aghila's family rejects Israeli army report on Palestinian journalist killing. The family of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghila, who was killed while covering a raid by Israeli regime troops in Jenin refugee camp on May 11th, has rejected an Israeli army report on her killing. The Israeli military released a statement that tried to obscure the truth and avoid responsibility for killing Shirin Abu Aghila, our aunt, sister, best friend, journalist, and a Palestinian-American, said the family in an open letter. The Abu Aghila family said that it is not surprised by this outcome since it is obvious to anyone that Israeli war criminals cannot investigate their own crimes. The family members insisted that they will continue to demand the U.S. government follow through with its stated commitments to accountability, but that requires action. Also, the website of Electronic Intifada, penned by Ali Abu Nima, said, the family of Shirin Abu Aghila rejected the results of Israel's official investigation into the slaying of the world-renowned Al Jazeera journalist. Abu Aghila was fatally shot in the head in Jenin on May 11th, as she and other journalists were covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city. Her colleague, Alia Samoudi, was shot in the back and injured. Lina Abu Aghila, the journalist's niece, said in a tweet sharing the family's reaction, we could never expect any type of accountability or legitimate investigation from the very entity responsible for gunning down an unarmed and clearly identifiable journalist. Earlier, the Israeli army claimed, according to the newspaper Haaretz, that Abu Aghila was likely mistakenly shot by an Israeli soldier while under fire, who was using a telescopic scope and misidentified her as an armed Palestinian gunman. There have been at least 9 separate investigations of Abu Aghila's killing. Eyewitnesses' accounts have been consistent that there were no exchanges of fire in the area at the time that Abu Aghila, who was clearly identified as a journalist, was killed. One of those investigations was conducted by CNN, which reported in May that it had obtained new evidence, including 2 videos of the scene of the shooting, that there was no active combat nor any Palestinian near Abu Aghila in the moments leading up to her death. Videos obtained by CNN, corroborated by testimony from 8 eyewitnesses, an audio forensic analyst, and an explosive weapons expert, suggest that Abu Aghila was shot dead in a targeted attack by Israeli forces, CNN added. Electronic Intifada added, in reality, the U.S. has been helping Israel get away with the murder, ignoring growing demands from members of Congress and the Abu Aghila family for the U.S. to launch its own investigation. Given its record, there is little reason to think Washington and its faithful followers in the European Union won't continue to play Israel's game unless the demands for real justice and accountability remain loud and constant. The recent Israeli announcement on Labor Day, a national holiday in the U.S., also raises suspicions that it was time to attract as little attention as possible. Notably, the U.S. picked July 4th, its own so-called Independence Day, and another major public holiday to issue a statement claiming that Washington could not reach a definitive conclusion regarding the origin of the bullet that killed the journalist. While the U.S. at the time acknowledged that Israel likely killed Abu Aghele, it offered justifications and excuses that were widely derided and rejected. Human rights groups have long pointed out that the main task of the Israeli regime Army Advocate General's office is not determining the truth, but shielding Israeli troops from accountability. In 2016, B'Tselem announced it would stop cooperating with the military investigation system. The Israeli human rights group said at the time, "We will no longer aid a system that whitewashes investigations and serves as a fig leaf for the occupation." Recently, B'Tselem dismissed the army's probe of Abu Aghele's killing as another whitewash, saying the slaying was no mistake and that it was instead Israeli policy. B'Tselem added, "Enormous public and international pressure was needed to make the Zionist regime spread a faint confession that one of its soldiers had killed journalist Shirin Abu Aghele, while at the same time shaking off any responsibility for her death. The killing of Abu Aghele is the predictable result of Israel's outrageous open fire policy in the occupied territories. This policy claims more and more victims, while the whitewash continues undisturbed."
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting two special guests. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much
Brother
for
Yasser,
having us.
How do you do?
I'm good, thank you.
And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
The honor and pleasure is all mine. We've been talking about the Arba'in Walk and the significance of this movement and how it serves the walkers, the pilgrims, the Zawar, spiritually, physically, mentally, psychologically, and the greater picture, the bigger picture and the greater purpose that is almost like the philosophy. I mean, we can't understand the absolute philosophy of everything, especially in religion. But perhaps one of the deepest philosophies of this is to really try to enrich ourselves with the knowledge and ma'rifah toward Imam al-Hussein's movement, right? I think every dimension of Arba'in is such a great manifestation of that. The struggles, the worries, the anxiety, the pain, and that spiritual elation you get. You're so elevated and you're so light and you carry that with you for like a whole lot, long while afterwards. So that's what we've been talking about with Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. So do you guys have like a last, what is the most recent statistic you have of people walking on Arba'in?
I've heard 25 million.
25 mil, right?
I don't know. I'm a bit skeptical about that, but I don't
until
know.
Last year, the statistics that the Ataba gave was
around... last year was a pandemic Arba'in.
Yeah, it was around 15.
Last year, I mean, like mid-pandemic and it was 15.
Yeah, it was around the 15 mark.
Right.
Yeah, but usually...
But the years before that,
it gets up to 25.
It would be interesting to know how they count it. Is that 25 altogether within the 10, 15 days? Or is it... How does it work?
So what they do is
So if they say 25 just at the Iran-Iraq border, I'd still believe that.
Okay, because when Karbala itself, like the entry points to Karbala, they do estimates, I think. They don't have a specific
But what's the
method.
Population of Karbala? Can it even hold 25 people?
Karbala itself? Mm. It can't.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think but, it's like no,
but,
total.
I think it includes people on the way.
No, but what happens is like you got to keep in mind like Arba'in, it's like there are people coming and people going.
Exactly.
They're
exactly.
not always at the same
exactly.
time.
So it's mobile.
So especially with Iraqis, I think this is the Iraqis something that Iraqis are doing. For them, they do the Arba'in like a day or 2 days prior to the Arba'in itself to make way for
the foreigners.
To make way for the Zubar.
I've actually met people going back when we're going towards
exactly.
Zubar, right?
Yeah. So there's it's a constant, it's like
it's a flow, basically. It's like
a
river.
Flow. People coming and people going. So you can't, you're not having people stuck at the same place because that would be just literally impossible. And I think I was there one of the years where it was just a standing halt. Like nothing was moving. There was so much people, nothing actually was moving. So, and then they started creating that kind of flow now. So, yeah. So it can carry 20 million people because most people, they come, they do the ziyarah and they leave. So,
but I think in terms of a global event, I don't think there's anything that matches up.
No.
Even if you take it over 10, 15 days,
it broke all
25
records
million
in the
people. Yeah.
Records, yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I am honored to have Brother Abdullah and Brother Yasir. We are continuing our discussion on the Arba'in Walk and the significant impact it has on the pilgrims' lives. And often, the significant impact it has on those who miss out on the walk as well, subhanAllah. So now that we've assessed the different dimensions of the population of Arba'in pilgrims, here's the question, right? 25 million pilgrims all walking toward a singular destination out of their pure love. I mean, whatever vices, whatever impurities of intention or like traits or personalities, they're all going for the intention, for the purpose of showing their love for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam any way they can. Right? That's basically it.
Yeah.
Right. So 25 million people, supposedly. The hadith says that if Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam has 313 companions, he'll reappear. Someone please help me do the math.
It's a small percentage of that, yeah.
So why? I actually had a friend ask me this question regarding the wars that, like, whether the war that happened during Daesh, all those mudafir that they went to defend the shrine of Sayyidina Zainab sallallahu alayha, the war between Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Israel, the 8-year imposed war between Iran and Iraq that gave, like, I don't know, 300,000 martyrs, I'm probably exaggerating. All of these wonderful people, plus 25 million that go for Arba'in Walk every year, and we are still lacking 313 decent human beings that can accompany Sahib al-Zaman, make it make sense.
I think that's the thing. Sahib al-Zaman is not looking for 313 decent human beings.
Interesting.
Right? The 313, first of all, we have to remember that it's not just 313. These are the in simple words, they're the top commanders, right? Mm. Or let's say the people who are going to be in charge. But there's a lot more people involved, right? Many people will be involved in the movement, right?
Yeah.
And will be coming there to help Imam. These 313 are selected people. You need to realize that, like, why did Imam Ali's hukuma not continue? Was it only because people asked him to rule, right? People asked him to lead. But he didn't have enough qualified people, qualified both in the spiritual sense, in the sense of having the right knowledge, having the right political insight, having the right management skills, you know, all of these things together. He didn't have enough of them to be able to manage his government, right? He had to put people who messed up sometimes, right? Yep, yep. If Imam Mahdi is supposed to be ruling the entire world and establishing Allah's just system, right, mm-hmm. and eradicating poverty and solving humanity's problems, and there are countless of problems, he can't do that with people with basic skills, right? He needs people who literally, if Imam says, come here and do this, they will come here and do that mm-hmm. exactly the way Imam says it, right? Right now, most of us are struggling to wake up for Salah in the morning on time. Right, Imam Allah tells us, okay, this time come pray. Well, I'll come in 5 minutes. Imam doesn't need that.
Right.
Imam needs that person who...
You say jump, I say how high.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But not only that, you say jump and he knows how high. Imam needs a person who has the ma'rifah, who not only obeys, not only submits, but he submits with ma'rifah. He knows what Imam expects. He has that tafaqquh in the deen. He has that understanding.
Insight, right.
At the same time, he has political insight. How many people believed in Imam Hussein? But they went against him because they didn't have a good understanding of their time.
Mm.
They would advise Imam Hussein, don't go to Karbala, you get killed. Like, duh. I know that, right? Don't come and teach me that.
Yeah.
You should have the insight to know that this is the right time to do this.
Right.
You see? A lot of Imam Hassan's companions turned against him, right? Why didn't you fight? You should know why I'm not fighting. You should be able to understand the current situation, the current political situation, you know, and realize that my decision is correct. Okay, if you don't have that much basira, if you don't have that much insight, it's okay, at least submit to me.
Mm.
You see? So there's not only submission. Some companions of the Imam submitted to the Imam, but they didn't know why Imam did that. In their hearts, they're like, you know, I'm not sure why Imam is doing this, but
he's
fine.
An Imam, okay, whatever.
Yeah, he's an Imam who submitted. And that's really great. That's amazing. Most of us, inshallah, would do this, right? But to be one of the 313, that's not enough. Because you're going to be now making decisions. You're going to be leading, right? Different parts of the world. You're going to be making decisions and applying that just system. You have to be really, really, really high, right? And the thing is, when I say it like that, many people are like, oh, then we can't. Why not?
Hopeless.
Right? We are able to do that. It's just that we don't want to. We don't want to put that effort to become that high.
Yeah.
Otherwise, all of us are at the same standing. And Imam says that people are going to be able to do that, right? We can be among the 313. It's just that we don't work hard enough. We give up too fast, right? Mm. Even for the basic stuff, for salah, for salm, for hajj, you know, we give up too fast. We don't put so much effort. And I feel like, maybe we don't really want to be among the 313. It's like one of those dreams that, oh, I wish I could do. But, you know, it's a lot of times we're like, oh, I wish I could earn $1 million a year. But then I don't really work for it,
no.
You know? So it's not a true, really, a real wish we have. It's something that would have been nice if I had it, right? It's a fantasy,
daydreaming.
I feel many of us are like that with regards to the Imams and me, a companion of the Imam, right?
So Sayyid, why do we have such a hadith? What does the hadith mean when it says the Imam needs 313 companions to reappear? And okay, like every year we have 25 million people marching to Imam.
All right, so let me give you a different dimension to this dilemma, which is this doubt that people sometimes raise.
The
first question I would bring forward is, who in God's name said Imam needs 313 to rise up?
I've seen a lot of a hadith on this.
Not a single one. Give me one.
Oh, wow. Really? You want me to go through the internet right now?
We have a hadith that says that Imam would have 313 companions, but his appearance is not waited or postponed on the 313.
It's not conditioned on them.
Now, according to Brother Yasser's answer, Imam Mahdi will never appear. Because we will never have mental capacity that you'd have so much people who are so God-fearing, so God-loving, so God-obedient. Because the army of Imam Zaman alayhi salam are 10,000. His command is 313. This is what the Rawaita are telling us. And then you have your Kharasani, you have your Yamani, and all this army. Now, the idea here is, with this might work with other Imams alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam, like you mentioned, Imam Hussein and all other Imams. This would work perfectly. And the Imams, they were always complaining from the fact that they did not have supporters who are quality supporters. This is was the complaint of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the complaint of Imam al-Hassan, the complaint of Imam al-Hussein. Even Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he complained about that. When a person came to him and said, "Oh, we are so many, why don't you rise?" I was like, "Okay, throw yourself in fire."
Hmm.
And the person said, "What?" And then he said to one of his companions, "Throw yourself in fire." The other guy went and jumped. So at the time of other imams, yes, this definitely applicable, that they did not have the quality in terms of believers. With Imam al-Zaman is completely different issue. It has nothing to do with even Imam al-Zaman himself. Even if he wants to appear tomorrow, it's not in his hand. Allah says, "Innama amruna baghta." The whole affair of dhuhur is in the hands of Allah. Whether 300 are there or not, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if he decides it's not time for it, it's not time for it. So when he says, we have a hadith that says Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, yasluhu amrahu fi layla. Allah will fix all the affairs of Imam al-Zaman in one single night. Which means that all these 313, all the signs that are, even the, as we call, the hatmi signs, they could be overridden. And the Imam says, yeah, bid'ah falls in all these signs. So is the Imam waiting for 313? No, he's not. Is he waiting for Sufyan al-Kharasani? No, he's not. What is he waiting for? He's waiting for the order of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the qadiyya, in the affair of Imam al-Zaman, it's so sensitive that it is in the hands of Allah. Even the Imam al-Zaman, when they asked him in many hadith, when they said, when that will happen, says, "I don't know. It's in the hands of God." If he could have said, "Oh no, I'm just waiting for 313. Once I have 313, I will come." Now I guarantee you there is more than 313 who are 100% God-fearing to the way the Imam loves them. There might be even millions of them.
That's but actually an awesome way to look at it.
Yeah, the idea is this, this whole concept of Mahdawiyya has to be looked at very delicately.
There's so much more to talk about regarding this topic, obviously. And that's all the time we have for today. So thank you so very much for being with us. Until another episode of Back to Reality, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
IRIB English Radio Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
Before Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary, even opened her mouth to testify on Thursday, 21st of July, before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol, the House Republican Conference attacked her on Twitter as a liar and a pawn of Democrats. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Annie Carney and Maggie Haberman, two journalists writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled, In January 6 Hearings, Gender Divide Has Been Strong Undercurrent. Before Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary, even opened her mouth to testify on Thursday, 21st of July, before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol, the House Republican Conference attacked her on Twitter as a liar and a pawn of Democrats. The group did not mention the man seated beside her, Matthew Pottinger, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, who was also there to issue a scathing indictment of President Donald J. Trump's behavior on the day of the riot. Nor did Donald Trump himself mention Mr. Pottinger when he lashed out hours later with a statement calling Sarah Matthews a fame seeker who was clearly lying. The contrast highlighted how, in a series of revelatory hearings that have focused on issues of democracy, the rule of law and the peaceful transfer of power, another less discussed theme has emerged. The gender dynamics that have been a potent undercurrent. In the course of exposing Donald Trump's elaborate effort to overturn the 2020 election, the House Select Committee has relied on the accounts of several women who came forward to publicly tell their stories. Their statements and the attacks that ensued laid bare how women often still pay a higher price than men for speaking up. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the vice chairwoman of the panel, a woman who herself has suffered heavy consequences for her insistence on publicly condemning Donald Trump's conduct, has been explicit about the role of gender in the proceedings. She has positioned herself as a champion of the women who have agreed to testify in public, comparing them favorably with the many men who have refused to do so. At the committee's primetime hearing on Thursday, 21st of July, Liz Cheney wore a white jacket, the colour of the women's suffrage movement. She invoked Margaret Thatcher, the first woman to serve as Prime Minister of Britain, and the fight by American women to secure the right to vote, as she described the women who had publicly appeared during the panel's investigation as an inspiration to American women and American girls. She was referring to Sarah Matthews as well as Cassidy Hutchinson, another White House aide who appeared at one of the committee's hearings. Caroline Edwards, a Capitol police officer who testified about how she was assaulted by the rioters, sustained a concussion and continued to fight them off. And Wandria Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, election workers from Georgia, who told the panel about how they endured harassment and even death threats after Donald Trump named them in a false conspiracy theory about voter fraud. The result has been that as the committee unfurls the story of the January 6th attack, playing footage of a mostly male crowd laying waste to the Capitol in Donald Trump's name, with the president looking on supportively from the West Wing, many of the witnesses who have emerged most prominently have been women, with Liz Cheney as their defender. It is a notable strategy by Liz Cheney, a tough and hawkish conservative who throughout her career has worked to avoid being viewed through the lens of gender. It comes as the Republican Party has labored to diversify and expand its appeal among female voters, a group that polls showed was a weak spot for Donald Trump in 2020 and has only drifted from him since. A recent New York Times Siena College poll found that 6 in 10 women believed Mr. Trump's actions after the 2020 election threatened democracy, while men were almost evenly split, with 48% holding that view and 45% saying he was just exercising his rights. Liz Cheney was the highest-ranking Republican woman on Capitol Hill last year when she broke with her party after the riot and called out Donald Trump and his election lies, voting to impeach him for incitement of insurrection. Within months, she had been ousted as the number 3 Republican in the House, and she is now at risk of losing her seat in Wyoming, as she faces a challenging primary election next month against a Trump-endorsed opponent. It was difficult not to hear some parallels when Liz Cheney described on Thursday how Cassidy Hutchinson, the 26-year-old former White House aide who became a critical public witness, knowingly exposed herself to harsh criticism from former colleagues. Ms. Cheney said that Ms. Hutchinson knew all along that she would be attacked by President Trump and by the 50, 60, and 70-year-old men who hide themselves behind executive privilege. But like our witnesses today, she has courage and she did it anyway, Liz Cheney added. After Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, Donald Trump dismissed her in an interview with Newsmax as this girl who was making up stories. "She's got serious problems, let me put it that way," he said, "mental problems." Amanda Carpenter, a former advisor to Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Jim DeMint of South Carolina, both Republicans, said it was notable to see a conservative woman drawing attention to the gender dynamic. "I know how hard it is for these women under these circumstances," Ms. Carpenter said. "I imagine it means a lot to the women being targeted. It means a lot to me just watching it." The Twitter attack by the House Republican Conference on Sarah Matthews, who works as a House Republican aide, was quickly deleted. But Donald Trump's targeting of her and Cassidy Hutchinson was in line with how the former president has often publicly treated women who challenge him, criticizing them in personal terms intended to call into question their credibility, their sanity and self-worth. Donald Trump's allies like to describe him as an equal opportunity counterpuncher who would attack anyone who crossed him. But over the years, he has singled out female antagonists with particular viciousness, including the television personalities Mika Brzezinski and Megyn Kelly, Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, and Mary T. Barra, the chief executive of General Motors. His allies, many of them seeking his approval, have mimicked his behavior. In the case of Cassidy Hutchinson, a person close to her said, "Stories have been shopped to Trump-friendly media outlets, smearing her personally." Garrett Ziegler, a junior aide in Donald Trump's White House, went on a misogynistic rant during a live stream this past week after sitting for an interview with the January 6th committee in which he repeatedly refused to answer questions. In the rant, he used sexist slurs against his former female colleagues who have cooperated with the inquiry. Pat Cipollone, Bill Barr, Mark Short, they're saying the same thing. yet you attack the young women, said former Representative Barbara Comstock of Virginia, a Republican whom Mr. Trump, in the past, branded as a rhino loser, for Republican in name only. Barbara Comstock was referring to the former White House counsel, the former Attorney General, and the former Chief of Staff to Vice President Mike Pence, all of whom gave closed-door testimony to the committee that painted Donald Trump in an unflattering light. This is a pattern, said Barbara Comstock, who is close to Liz Cheney. The president does this, and this is intentional. Some of the male witnesses have also suffered professional consequences and public rebukes for their candor. Rusty Bowers, the Arizona House Speaker and a Republican, was censured by his state's Republican Party after his emotional testimony before the committee. Mr. Bowers, who is running for re-election, told NBC News that it would take a miracle for him to survive politically. And William Barr, who as Attorney General directly told Donald Trump that his claims of election fraud had no merit, echoed the sentiment about the realities of cooperation. I get a lot of vitriol from the right, William Barr said in a brief interview. Yet while male witnesses have received some criticism from the right, in Mr. Cipollone's case, Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., tweeted that he should grow a spine and go on record. The attacks have not been at the same volume or intensity or of the same degree of personal nastiness as those against Cassidy Hutchinson in particular. Donald Trump's allies insist they have substantive concerns about what Cassidy Hutchinson has told the committee. They have raised specific challenges on matters of fact in her testimony, honing in on a discrepancy between her account and that of Eric Hirschman, a former White House lawyer. Each has claimed authorship of a handwritten note displayed at one of the hearings that provided instructions for what the president could have told the rioters on 6 of January 2021. There has also been an effort to undermine the veracity of some of the most explosive parts of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. Secret Service officials who spoke to reporters on the condition of anonymity disputed a scene that Ms. Hutchinson said that she had been told about, in which Donald Trump was said to have grabbed a Secret Service agent and lunged for the steering wheel of the SUV he was riding in, as he demanded to be driven to the Capitol on 6 of January 2021. But the swiftness of the Twitter attack on Sarah Matthews was notable, given that it came from her own colleagues. The Twitter account for the House Republican conference that singled her out is run by two former Trump campaign aides. Under the stewardship of Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, who replaced Liz Cheney as the number three House Republican, the Twitter account has taken on an aggressive tone throughout the hearings, intended to please the proverbial audience of one.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.